Ladies and gentlemen, we are live from scenic Los Angeles. Can he has cheeseburger? It's time to speak some English with Andrew English.
I think I have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that I can has cheeseburger. You guys have seen my gut. Pack them away. Welcome, everybody, to an exciting new episode of Speaking English. Got a lot to talk about tonight. Obviously, just finished up a very exciting week in the Champions League round of 16. We've got eight teams heading on to the quarterfinals, and we're going to talk for at least a little while about the fact that four of those eight teams for the second year in a row are from England. We're also going to talk a little bit about Valencia's monetary woes right now and how that might impact some of the British teams and some of the Spanish teams next season as their players get poached slowly but surely. Chat a little bit about David Beckham's ongoing love affair with Milan, and then move on to some NHL action. So, guys, did you happen to catch any of the Champions League matches this week?
Yeah.
I caught like the first 15 minutes of the Man U match, and then I accidentally found out the final score, so I bailed.
Oh, that's criminal. Well, obviously, lots and lots and lots of excitement. Man U didn't really deserve, I don't necessarily know, based off of their performance to go through. I mean, I felt like Inter had their chances, Ibrahimovic especially, and kind of blew it a little bit. But it's hard to argue with the way Man U's played recently. Liverpool demolished Real Madrid, which I was thrilled to see, 4-0. Arsenal somehow skated through against Roma on penalties, and Chelsea beat Juventus. So what I'm real curious about, guys, this is the second year in a row now that four of the final eight teams are from England. I think at least three English teams have been in the quarterfinals for the past four seasons at this point. Does this speak to something larger, I guess, regarding the English league? Is there some reason that these English teams are predisposed to be successful in the Champions League, whether or not it's a ton of money coming in or just the way they play?
Well, I actually was thinking about this, and, you know, they played three different Italian teams, and I was thinking about it when I was watching the matches, and I pulled up some information, and to a large degree, I think it's just the way they play. I'm looking at Juventus's lineup, Roma's lineup, and Inter's lineup, and I'm looking at the only quick players I can see, and I'm just going to go down all three, is that the only quick player I can see that Juventus had out was Molinaro, and Roma had, well, Reese is kind of quick, and Vucinic is maybe a little fast, and then Inter had, I think David Senton and Maicon are fairly quick. And I guess for his size, Ibrahimovic, kind of fast. But that, my point is, that's it. Everybody else in the field is old, is Tati, or is Nedved, or Trezeguet, or, I mean, Iaquinta is, like, makes this, he looks fast out there. And then he's supposed to be playing against Anelka, and even just these explosive English teams. And it's like, you watch, and it's just obvious. It's like the reason why the English teams do so well is because, Or just happen to score or just do whatever they need to do is because at the end of the day they can outrun the entire other team.
I'm gonna go the other. I'm first off, Carl. I'm humbled by your ability to have rosters in front of you. That's some dynamite research. I think that the we definitely owe a thanks to the speaking English intern on that one.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Gustavo.
He does great work. I don't know. I'm inclined. I think that is one of the, you know, one of the symptoms of the English success, Carl. But I just think that the reason they're quicker and the reason that they're just better categorically is English teams are the ones buying all the new, you know, fresh players these days. I just think it's the money. If you look at the four English teams that are in the final rounds, I mean, with the exception of Arsenal, all have had new ownership come in recently, and that new ownership has been extremely willing to spend lots of money on the team.
That's not true. Arsenal hasn't, you know, they don't have a ton of money. I think that these Italian teams have
all except
money.
One.
Oh, I'm
Arsenal
sorry.
By exception.
I'm sorry. But and Liverpool's, I mean, they haven't gotten a huge injection. I don't think that they've had the ability to spend any more than these Italian teams.
They spent $30 gazillion dollars on Fernando Torres, and then they wasted.
Yeah, but he's just one player. I mean, they put out these central midfielders playing all over the place. They keep playing really old guys when they have younger, better guys sitting on the bench. It's like they just don't put their fast players onto the pitch, not so much that they don't have them.
Here's the way I look at it. Obviously, there is a ton of money being dumped into these teams. You look at the lineups, especially of Man U, Arsenal, and Chelsea. You're right. They are very quick teams. I think the big thing to my mind anyways, is that when you watch Serie A or when you watch the Primera Liga, you see that the way that the Spanish and Italian teams are successful is they sit back, they control the game, and they play at a speed that's comfortable for them, that allows them to slowly build up a creative attack, string together a bunch of passes, and ultimately, hopefully, put the ball in the back of the net. Whereas these English teams are able to go out, and they're just sort of like battering rams on the field. Arsenal, not so much necessarily, but the speed is a huge issue. And I think the fact that they have so much more speed, that they have so much more physical presence on the field, really allows them to go in and throw these teams that, you know, theoretically at least, are very talented off of their game. I mean, you would have to say that on paper, just the amount of skill between Man U and Inter, there's really not a heck of a lot of a discrepancy there. But Man U is, they can go out and they can play direct attacking football. And none of the Spanish and none of the Italian teams ever play direct football. It just doesn't happen. They want to slow the game down. They want to take their time and they want to build up an attack. And I don't think that the English style really permits that.
Although also, you know, if you're just looking at the lineups, they don't put skilled players out there. Like, you look at Inter, and they've got Cambiasso, Vieira, and Zanetti, and Stankovic. And Stankovic is, I guess, he's theoretically pretty skillful. But the other guys, they're all just, I mean, they're not technically good enough. I don't know, I don't know, it just doesn't seem like the Italians, and I mean, it's all kind of like, we're all kind of saying things that I agree with, so I don't mean to sound like I disagree so much, is that I just get frustrated that the Italian teams just don't seem to realize that they have to, like, it seems like they get so stuck in their ways, they don't seem to realize that they have to put quick players and strong players out against the English teams, because ultimately that's the, strong and fast wins the games.
Yeah, it really does. I'm most surprised by Inter's failure to do anything against Man U, just because Mourinho is so familiar, I mean, intimately with the English game. He knows how to beat Sir Alex Ferguson. He's done it, you know, on a number of occasions. And the way that they played the other night just didn't suggest that he was really trying to play. It suggested that he was trying to play to the strengths of his team in Serie A, which is not the way that you can go out and win a game against a team like Manchester United. And I'm really shocked, given his level of experience as opposed to, you know, Luciano Spalletti at Roma or somebody like that, Claudio Ranieri over at Juventus. Even Ranieri has plenty of premiership experience, but Juve at least.
And they played, I would argue, they gave the best run of all three of these.
Well, they absolutely did. And I honestly, had Cellini not gotten sent off, I think that Juventus would certainly have had a very good shot of clawing their way back into that one and hopefully going through. I mean, Chelsea got pretty lucky. I mean, Lampard had a pretty spectacular free kick that went off the bar, but it was kind of fluky that the ball fell down to Essien for that tap-in. And beyond that, I mean, if Cellini hadn't gotten the red card, I feel like Juventus could have pushed a little bit harder. They certainly looked like they were more than capable of going out and competing with that Chelsea team. So I think that was just a matter of a poor decision on Cellini's part and you know, things just didn't come through for them in the end, but they definitely acquitted themselves pretty well. I'm curious to see what's going to happen in this next round, honestly. I kind of hate the idea that we might wind up with another all-English final in the Champions League, because I feel like that takes a lot of the fun out of the Champions League. I mean, ultimately, if you're winding up with Arsenal playing Chelsea or Liverpool playing Man U or however it breaks down, if that happens, honestly, it feels like a domestic cup final. There's nothing really special about it to me. And I would really, really love to see a couple of these teams, obviously not Liverpool, please, get knocked out in the quarterfinals. But it'll definitely be interesting regardless. I mean, there are some great matchups to be had. And the way that Bayern played against Sporting Lisbon, I mean, admittedly not the greatest opposition in the world, but putting up 12 goals over two legs on that team, I mean, that's something pretty spectacular right there.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and move along for the time being. I wanted to talk just briefly about the state of affairs at Valencia right now. Obviously, there are a lot of teams in big-time financial trouble right now. I mean, some of these English teams are getting in a bad state. But there was some research done recently that suggested that overall the 20 teams in La Liga, I think, are 2.8-some-odd billion dollars in debt right now. And Valencia in particular is they're 450 million euros in debt. They haven't been able to pay some of their star players recently. I think they owe between just David Villa and Silva, they owe something like 10 million pounds. So it's a ridiculous amount of money there. And it's starting to look like Valencia has a very good chance of getting seized by the bank, going into receivership, and having to sell off a large quantity of their team. So I just want to talk a little bit, because obviously they have a lot of very skillful players, and a number of whom have been chased by teams in the Premiership. If David Villa goes to Man City, as has already been discussed, I mean, there's already been talks between Valencia and Man City over his transfer. Liverpool's chasing Raul Albiol. Silva has a very good shot of going really to any of the big four teams. Do you think that these players could come out of Valencia and have a significant impact in the Premiership?
I actually don't. I mean, I'm not sold on David Villa at especially just in terms of his style of play. Like, I don't see how he's any different than guys that Manchester City already have.
Yeah, I agree.
I worry about that transfer in particular, because that's making the Villa front line awfully awfully similar.
You mean
the City front line?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I agree with you, Wes. And I think that to broaden that, I think that Silva is a great technically player, but I think he might be that kind of guy who comes to England and gets pushed around a little bit too much. And so I'm thinking that maybe some of these wide players like Joaquin or Vicente or Mata that you have down there, maybe some of the wide players. I mean, if a player's going to come over from Spain, wide player is the best kind.
Yeah, I think that's probably very true.
What's going to happen pricing wise. I mean, with the exception of the cities of the world and the teams with eccentric billionaires, I mean, as the global economic crisis continues, do you think that there's any danger of Villa kind of struggling for buyers? I mean, how many they're going to, even in receivership, David Villa is going to command a pretty hefty fee. And besides the teams that are run in such a way that the dollar figure doesn't matter, there aren't gonna. I worry that there won't be very many players.
I understand. Well, so his final purchase price will. I mean, I guess there's enough teams with billionaires to buy him, but his final purchase price won't be as high as Valencia wants it to be.
No, it definitely won't. I mean, here's the thing about Villa. He is an excellent striker, has been great in Spain and for the Spanish national team for a number of years now. And, I mean, he still hasn't really even hit his full-on prime at this point. But Valencia has effectively hung on to him for several years at this point by pricing him at 150 million euros or more. which obviously is completely ludicrous. And the state they're in right now, they can't – when they can't even afford to pay him, they clearly can't afford to try and price clubs out by setting his cost that high. And I feel like he's a guy, regardless of how well he'll come over and actually perform in the Premiership, which I think that he might not – I think he probably won't be as good in the Prem, but I could still see him being very successful because he is an ex-toucher. He's got some pace, and he reads defenses really well. He plays really, really well off of the center backs and finding space. I think that's a little more useful when the center backs are smaller and try to kind of play the ball out of defense a little bit more, as happens in the Spanish league. But I still think that any of the clubs that can afford to do it would probably be willing to shell out 25 or 30 million pounds on a player like David Villa, who is so proven in Spain. I think the other guys are – there's a little bit more of a question. I mean, Silva is somebody who, you know, theoretically right now we're the club in not such bad shape. They could probably try and charge 20 or 30 million pounds for, but there's no way that's going to happen. And if this club is getting sold off or is getting seized by the bank, then I have a feeling we're going to see a situation like we saw with Leeds, you know, a number of seasons back, where these guys are going at really cut rate prices.
Yeah, they'll get rid of everybody. They have to.
They're going to, I mean, when it comes down to it, these guys want to win championships and they want to get paid. And regardless of whether or not they feel like they have the capability in a team like Valencia of winning La Liga or winning Champions League, they will not play if they're not getting paid.
No,
and I'm sorry,
when you're owed
5 or 10 million pounds, that's a big fucking deal.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a realistic possibility, given how much talent and especially young talent they have there, that we could see some decent players come over. I'm excited about the prospect, honestly, of Raul Albiol, if Liverpool is able to swoop in and get him, just because he's a very fast and very strong defender. He's not really in the traditional Spanish mold of defenders, and I feel like he's probably somebody who could come over and excel. And I agree with you, Carl. I think Vicente, I think that Joaquin could probably come over and do very well as pure wingers in the Premiership.
I mean, I'm a little more skeptical about Albiol, just because I don't feel like he's tall enough to be a good English central defender, and he's not skillful enough to be a good fullback.
Yeah. But I mean, here's the thing. He's 6 foot or 6'1". I don't think that Vidic is much taller than that. I mean, Vidic is not he's a hulking guy, obviously, but he's not extremely tall. And I feel like
Vidic is 6'2", but it's, I mean, okay, at least it's an inch taller. And I feel, I just, to me, 6'2 is like kind of the minimum standard for being a top Premiership central defender.
How tall is, Cannavaro, is it? No, I can't, I'm blanking. The Italian captain.
Well, Cannavaro, who plays in Italy.
Yeah, I mean,
thinking of the Italian national team center back, and I blanked on the name. I'm sorry about derailing your train of thought. I think you can get by as a smallish central defender if you've got, you know, strength and a good partner.
I guess they're just not. I'm trying to think of them who actually does it.
I'm not sure what you mean there.
Like,
but
how many guys in England are actually regularly that? I guess
Jamie Carragher is 6 foot tall.
I guess, all right, I'll give it to you.
And I mean, he's consistently one of the best center backs in the league. Now, you know, pairing Carragher with somebody like Albiol, who's also not that tall, as opposed to Skrtel, who I think is like 6'3", or Agger, who's 6'2", it's a little bit different. But I still feel like he'd have the capability of excelling. But I do think I agree with you that the wide players, also Juan Manuel Mata, who's a very good young left winger, I think that that those are the sort of players who really have the best shot of coming over and excelling.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you think that this Valencia situation is something we're going to see more of? I mean, you read horror stories every season of you know, tremendous debt incurred by teams and you know, shaky financial footing and you know, the Glazers with all of their, you know, loan money used to purchase Manchester United and the fears at Chelsea that the ownership will just up and bolt. And
I wouldn't,
do you feel like Valencia is kind of an outlier, or do you think that we might get realistically to the chance where there really are only a couple of teams that are able to move and kind of do things in the transfer market, and everybody else is going to be, you know, perpetually balancing budgets and offloading talent?
I do. I think that there's a couple teams in England that I worry about. I worry about Arsenal's long-term future. I think they just got screwed with this new stadium and with the economy crashing around it. Now they have all this debt, and all they have is this stadium asset, which is going to be losing value, and it's going to be harder to fill. They have to charge less for tickets, so that all the revenue associated with the stadium is going to be going down. I could just see the stadium sort of being their Titanic.
Yep, absolutely. I think that that's a very real possibility. I mean, Liverpool seems to be in a reasonably stable situation right now, and if these Kuwaiti investors that are talking about buying the club come in, then there's they could be fine for a while longer. But I mean, realistically, right now they have almost 250 million euros worth of debt, and you know, that's nothing to shake a stick at, especially when Valencia's only got 450. You look at a team like Man City, where obviously the owners have come in with the idea that they're just going to be able to play fantasy football effectively and load up on all the best players in the world, load the club up with a bunch of debt. And I think ultimately, if they're not successful in another couple of years, if David Villa goes over there, he could find himself in this exact same situation a few more years down the road if those guys back out. Because I'm sorry, they've come in, they've dropped a ton of money with the expectation that they are going to be competing for top honors domestically and in Champions League. And if that doesn't seem like a realistic possibility a couple of years down the line, right now there's nothing to suggest that it will, then I would not be at all surprised to see them pull out and leave Man City hanging.
Yeah, I agree with that. Sure. I mean,
Oh, sorry, Carl, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, I was just say, I think you could extend that even to Chelsea. I think that to some degree, Hiddings had some success, and then, you know, even though they didn't beat Juventus very confidently, they got by. And I think it sort of distracted people from this, what's the hell's going on at Chelsea? Because still, at the end of the year, this summer, Abramovich very well might get rid of the team. And, I mean, then suddenly they're in bad, I would think, potentially in a bad situation.
Oh, they're in dire straits. And let me ask you this. If you're any one of these FAs, you know, La Liga, Italy, the English EPL, obviously, is it time to, I mean, for the long-term health of the game, it can't be a good thing to have multiple teams in your league propped up solely on the interest of a billionaire. I mean, essentially, there are multiple teams, and I go back to England because I'm most familiar with it, but there are, you know, two teams at the very least in England whose solvency is completely a product of the fact that a single person happens to be interested in soccer at the moment and happens to be magnificently wealthy.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
So are you kind of encouraging the idea of a, because it'd have to be a UEFA-wide salary cap?
Or something like it, you know, this is surely not a sustainable.
No,
cycle.
It's not.
You
You're absolutely right.
People are taking subprime mortgages on their teams. Like, how do you look at Chelsea's squad and Chelsea's financial books and say anything other than what we've already said, and that, oh, thank God Abramovich isn't bored.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. I mean, they will be £500 million in debt. They are £500 million in debt, but they're in debt to him. The big concern from Chelsea's perspective should be, I was reading earlier today, and I don't know if this is entirely accurate or not, but they're speculating that Abramovich may have lost as much as £12 billion of his £15 billion fortune. And I mean, if he's in that kind of situation right now, then you have to imagine that the prospect of an extra £500 million looks pretty exciting to him.
Well,
especially
this is
Chelsea is not achieving the results that he expects from them.
And this is the thing that I keep coming back to. The American sports environment, the NBA, the NFL, MLB, the NHL, all of the American sports are very concerned about their economies. Further, kind of building on that, the American sporting leagues, from a financial perspective, you know, are actually fairly well run. With the exception of MLB, they're cap leagues. There are constraints in place that prevent teams from doing anything incredibly stupid. They're fairly well managed, and they're still terrified. And then you look at the economic situation in America, and it's really no better than it is anywhere else in the world. And I just the amounts that soccer teams spend on their players are just astronomical.
Oh yeah, it's got to change. But then you know you enter the. It can't change. There's so many obstacles to it that don't exist in American sports. Just the incredibly complicated structures with all the different leagues and all the different countries that are all competing against each other. They can't. And if they all operate independently, then I mean, if one establishes some sort of salary cap or something, then they've just effectively eliminated themselves from Champions League.
Right, and I mean, and that brings me to another point is that even if we remove the eccentric billionaire problem from the equation here, so much of a soccer league's value is tied up in TV revenue. You know, making the Champions League, making UEFA, you know, these are huge financial windfalls. What happens when these things start to reduce themselves? I mean, it's at some point, people are going to stop attending games because they can't afford it. And if your team isn't making, you know, if you don't make the second round of UEFA and you're dealing with a major, you know, attendance drop, that's potentially crippling. The Boltons of the world are incredibly susceptible.
No, they aren't. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's...
Well, the lower league teams are the worst off. I mean, there's just too many damn teams in all these countries.
Well, you know, I mean, don't actually know if the lower league teams are that bad off. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you there, Wes.
Well, we were making the exact same point at the exact same time.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like those teams are more grounded in reality. They're not paying – I mean, so maybe they're shelling out, you know – £1.5 or £2 million for a player, but it's a heck of a lot less exorbitant than anything you're seeing from the Giants in world football.
Yeah.
I feel like their costs are so much less on a week to week basis. The fans, I think, of those lower league teams probably tend to be the local fans, the ones who are going to be going to the games on a regular basis, tend to be a little more loyal, I think, probably. And I don't think that you'll see the same kind of issues with those teams. But obviously, if we see a collapse of, you know, all or even a significant handful of teams in the Premiership and Serie A and La Liga, I mean, that sort of stuff is ultimately going to filter down. And I feel like the only way to stop this ultimately, given the way the economy looks right now, is to completely overhaul FIFA, UEFA regulations as far as player transfers and player ownership are concerned. I mean, as much as I have dogged on the MLS's system in the past, I feel like it wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing for a lot of these European leagues to start gravitating towards some sort of centralized governance of the teams and of the finances. Because I don't think – I mean, no team, if they have somebody – you know, like an Abramovich or like these Saudi investors, are going to turn away that kind of money right off the bat. But they don't necessarily look at the long-term problems that it can create. And if you had some system set up whereby there was a more even distribution of wealth, whereby there was a governing body that was effectively making the ultimate decisions over the teams on who was sold and who was purchased, how many players could be purchased at any given time, or how much money could be spent by any team at any given time, I feel like in the long run, these leagues would probably be a lot better off. Because what I'm envisioning right now is effectively a meltdown of European soccer.
Definitely. Well,
this is to build on that, Drew. What about we've all talked many times about the existing problems with competitive balance in international soccer, and this is only going to deepen that, because you'll have, you know, a super group of teams that are completely divorced from reality because they've got, you know, a billionaire oil investor or some sort of mechanism, and then you'll have the rest of the league, which is just scraping by. So it's already a problem with kind of stagnation at the top, and it's only going to get worse as teams that have to rely on actually balancing their books and actually, you know, the teams that have to give a damn about how many fans are coming to watch their games, as they get more affected, then they will fall even further away from the teams that just, you know what, we'll just buy another player, whatever.
I wish that I could be as optimistic as you guys, but the way I see it is that because of how incredibly complicated all the structures of all the different FAs around the whole of Europe are, and how many different organizations there are, and how incredibly difficult it would be to coordinate all this and get everybody to agree on it and all that, that it won't happen. And instead, what's going to happen is that all the little teams who are already just barely scraping by, of which there must be tons, just who are barely scraping by on ticket revenue as is because they don't have any TV contracts are all going to start failing. You're going to have these big teams that are going to fail, and they're going to get relegated, and they're going to drop way down. I think ultimately the leagues are just going to shed lots of teams, and the whole structure is going to change. But I just don't think that with all the different people involved and all the different countries involved and all the different organizations involved, and that I just cannot see how any sort of governmental body that would fix the problem could possibly be created.
Well, the solution I see, Carl, is actually – I think that we're going to get to a point where there's almost, and they've talked about it before, the G14 clubs. I think that we're going to see a super league. I think that it will eventually make sense for these controls to be put in place, and you'll have your local FAs, you know, come up with their own items, and you'll have the Man U's and the, you know, almost, you know, hey, there's a buy-in for, you know, X hundred million pounds your team gets in the door, and, you know, just the Champions League will become its own sort of self-sustaining entity, and it will kind of shuck off the, you know, the Aston Villas and the Manchester Cities, but not any longer, but the Boltons of the world. And you'll have the teams that can compete on that level and the teams that can't, and they'll just find a way to separate themselves.
Well, but I mean,
imagine if I own Blackburn right now, I cannot imagine I can't see a way that I'm ever competitive with Manchester United, and I can't see a way that I'm ever going to, you know, really get there.
I agree with you, Wes. I think that that's what will happen. I mean, it already makes sense. You know, I mean, economically for these teams, it just makes sense. So I agree with you. I think we'll end up with that. Just economics will force it.
Here's my problem with that whole rationale is that there are really only three leagues that possess teams with that kind of spending power. And out of those leagues, you could probably pull together 10, maybe 12 teams at the most that are really capable of competing at that absolute highest level, both fiscally and on the pitch. And I don't think that – I mean, right now you look at Champions League, and, you know, one of the great things about Champions League is that you've got teams from all of these different countries competing against each other. And, you know, even though they may not be
– Sorry, I'll let you finish. I apologize for interrupting.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't think that that's the best part of the Champions League. I mean, you've got the best part about the Champions League is you see the same 8 to 10 teams play every season. You see the same, you know, the one good German team play against the, you know, three or four good Italian teams and the, you know, two or three good Spanish teams and the four good English teams. I mean, that's it. Well, and I think that
Even Bayern Munich came.
No, but the Sporting Lisbon of the world. No, Sporting Lisbon is just going to show up and get smoked every year.
Well, no, and the thing about it is that if you do have a big league like that, is that the Bayern Munichs and the other kind of teams that can kind of barely make it, after they've been in that league with the government and the profit sharing and everything that will be going on, after they've been in that league for a couple of years, they'll all have the same amount of money anyway.
I think Bayern's squad is competitive now.
Well, and if financially they aren't, they would be after being in that league for a few years.
Right. I'm saying that they're not at a point financially right now where they could honestly even conceive of a $100+ million buy-in. Like I think tosses that idea out the window.
Here's
from my perspective, and I understand completely what you're saying, Wes, but it was only, what, 4 or 5 years ago that Mourinho won the Champions League with Porto in a final against Celtic. I mean, we aren't that far removed.
Porto beat Manchester United, and then they beat
Lyon. I think it was Lyon. It was a French team, I think.
But I think that in the years
Monaco.
That have intervened, in the years since that happened, things have changed so dramatically.
When
Porto beat Lyon, had Abramovich purchased Chelsea yet, or was it forthcoming?
I think he might have just purchased them that season, but Ranieri was still in charge. They hadn't had a chance to go out and spend a ton of money in the transfer window. So
if you find the 10 to 12 top revenue generating teams in the world, the Reals and the Barcas and the ACs and the Inters and the Romas, and if you find the top two or three teams from every league, there's enough to make a better league there, and those teams operate on a different level from everybody else, and sooner or later something's going to force the issue that those teams cannot operate on their different level with all of the other teams and have the leagues remain sustainable, and so they have to go.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be forced by the financial situation. It's just going to be the desolation of these leagues and the few teams that manage to survive it. The league structure is going to be ruined. So there's going to have to be a replacement.
Yeah, I guess I do understand and agree in principle with what you're saying. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of national pride attached to these teams. I feel like fans of Man U and Chelsea and Arsenal and AC Milan would have issues with the fact that their teams weren't still competing in a domestic league. I mean, I feel like that would be inherently problematic for them. I don't know that it's not like I've got a better solution. I'm just saying I think there are still a lot of obstacles. There's no way to streamline a transition like that.
Oh, no.
And I think that there's going to be a hell of a lot of opposition from supporters of the clubs, from people within the governing bodies of soccer. I think that it's just going to be a very, very difficult thing to implement.
I just feel like the fans will eventually get sick of watching their teams playing against inept competition.
I think that the fans will prefer it. If I was a Man U fan, I mean, aren't you more excited and from a national pride perspective, if Liverpool has, two or three league games against, Barcelona every year. I'm excited about that. I get to see nothing but the Ronaldinhos and the Kakas and the, I get nothing but those players. Every single matchup has pride on the line, be it international pride, an English team versus a German team or English pride. Yeah, every game has meaning. As opposed to now, like Carl is saying, half of the games on Manchester United's, or just because you're a fan, Drew, half of the games on Liverpool's schedule this season, if not more, the dynamic consists of the other team trying as hard as possible to get nil-nil or not get blown out.
No,
it's a constant stream of the the Robbie Savages and the Jimmy Bullards and the mallet-headed whomevers going and just, you know, turning games into these sloppy, choppy, let's just not get scored on and take the point affairs. And it just it gets old, I think. And it's to me, I would be much more interested if I was a fan of a high level team. I would be much more interested and much more supportive of watching my high level team play against nothing but other high level teams. And as far as objections from the league, I think it will get to the point when the league is not going to have a say anymore because those teams are more influential. And they can just elect to, why do they will get a sweeter TV deal or whatever, and they will not need the revenue stream that the FA provides. And it will get to the point when the FA's solution will be to say, well, we're not going to cut you into our EPL deal, and it's just not going to matter because they'll have a sweeter one.
Yeah, that's perfectly reasonable, I suppose.
Cynical, but
yeah,
probably
realistic.
Realistic.
All right. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about a league that's not in terribly dire financial straits right now.
And then you would never guess that would be the NHL.
I think that not in dire straits might be a tad optimistic. It's not in as dire straits. We'll put it that. We'll say that.
There you go. I know, Wes, you wanted to chat a little bit about the firing of Guy Carboneau in Montreal. The Canadiens maybe have not performed as well as people would have hoped this year. Kovalev has had a little bit of an off season. Tanguay was injured throughout a large part of the year, but they're still solidly. I think they're fifth place in the East right now. They're still solidly in the playoff picture. They were on a 2-game losing streak when Carboneau got fired. What really precipitated this? And do you honestly think that Bob Gainey is going to do a better job and is going to be able to take this team anywhere in the playoffs?
I think it was the classic hockey firing in that hockey teams give up very quickly on coaches. Yes, it's only a 2-game losing streak, but one of the games that they won to snap that losing streak was a game in Dallas where Montreal managed to give up 10 power plays, including a 2-minute and 51-second 5-on-3 advantage that Dallas was unable to score on. So to say that that is a positive win is a, you know, it's a, I would very much like to say that Montreal, you know, battled and proved something with that win, but it was a laugher. I think that the firing is interesting. First off, in that earlier this season, when it's the centennial season for Montreal, they've been in the league 100 years. It's supposedly this big celebration. They had the All-Star game. All of this stuff was lining up, and I think that Carboneau's, and then they just fell flat. Carey Price, the heir apparent goalie, has been awful. They've gotten nothing out of Kovalev. I mean, to say slightly off is a joke. He was basically told to go home for a week about a month ago by his coach, and nobody's playing well. The team has struggled. They're back in the playoff picture now, but that's been a fairly recent development. And I'm personally fine with the Carboneau firing for a couple of reasons. First off, they've got this young goaltender in Carey Price, who's supposedly the future of the franchise, and Carbo manages to completely alienate the kid during last year's playoffs. I mean, in Carboneau's defense, Price was awful. He definitely started to show strain and cracked, and I believe it was a series against Philadelphia. He was especially kind of wretched. But Carboneau really bungled it. He called him out in the media, and he just really kind of wrecked this very young kid's energy and his self-confidence. And then I've always said that one of the biggest jobs of a coach, and I blasted Scolari on this earlier, but one of the biggest jobs of a coach is to get along with your best players. And Kovalev is his team's best player, and he clearly doesn't care. And you have to do something. And yeah. So I think that his firing is kind of a product of the classic mentality of, well, the guy that they have is not – the team is less than the sum of its parts. There are noticeable gaps between, you know, a guy's ability and his performance, and you can't fire the players.
Yeah, and that's perfectly reasonable. I mean, I think that saying that Kovalev has been absolutely awful is a bit of an overstatement. He's got, at this point in the season, he's played 65 games. He's got 16 goals and 31 assists. You definitely expect him to be scoring more goals than that. But 47 points is not a terrible haul. I mean, if he had 30 points right now, that would be problematic. But, I mean, a couple seasons ago, he was at 47 points in 73 games that he played with the team, and he was also a minus 19. Now, admittedly, the team was much worse. He played very well last season and really hasn't lived up to that. But, I mean, you also got to look at it and say, okay, well, this guy is 35 years old now. He's not going to be the player he used to be, and you have to expect there's going to be some drop-off in performance.
He's got exactly half the points that he scored last season. He's been the best power play in the league last year that was driven largely by his goals has dried up. He's supposed to be the team's leader, and this is also a guy that is notable for his disappearing acts. I mean, his career totals have fluctuated because the guy's just inconsistent as hell.
Yeah, he definitely is. I mean, as a Penguins fan, I've definitely seen those streaks out of him in the past. But I mean, that said, given that he has made it his sort of his trademark, is it really? I mean, can you really blame Carboneau for that? I mean, I understand that is the philosophy when it comes to really most major sports these days, but especially in hockey, it seems like. But I mean, can you really fault Carbo for Kovalev's failings this year?
I think you have to, because you can't fault Kovalev. It's a guaranteed contract. Nobody else wants him. I think you can't do nothing. I don't think that you can do nothing, because Kovalev's current performance is not good enough. He has not been good enough this season. And I think that if you're Bob Gainey, you know, you have to answer to bosses as well, and your team is – the GM has to do something to spark the team. He's got a too young goaltender. He's got a superstar player that doesn't care. Both of those players are more valuable than the coach.
That's very true. Just out of curiosity –
the funniest part about this, though, is it was just a couple of months ago that things were going worse than they are now, and Gainey got out in front of the media and said something to the effect of, "Thank God we have Carboneau, or things would be so much worse." And now he's canned the guy.
Well, I mean, that's part of the shocking thing. I mean, these guys have a long-standing friendship. They've known each other for a long, long time. And
they were in it to the Stanley Cup team in Dallas. I mean, these guys are long pedigree of success and success together. Carboneau
exactly.
was one of the players that Bob Gainey brought in explicitly because the Stars weren't going to win a cup. He looked at a roster that had gotten upset in the first round against Edmonton, decided they weren't good enough, and one of the first guys he went after was Guy Carboneau.
Yep. You know, I think it's a sad state of affairs. I think that Carboneau's definitely going to get another shot. I mean, in three seasons in Montreal, this is the first time that he had fewer than 42 wins. And honestly, the team is on pace at this point that had he hung around, they probably would have hit that total with another, 16, 17 games, whatever's left in the regular season. So I think that he'll probably get another shot. I'm curious to know, because I don't honestly think that Montreal has a tremendously strong defense. Do you think that Price's problems? I mean, their best defender is there's Andrei Markov, who is a purely offensive defender. Roman Hamrlik's kind of in the same mold. Outside of that, you've got Matthew Dandino, Mike Komisarek. And they just brought in Matthew Schneider, who admittedly has been pretty good. He was floundering in Atlanta. But do you think that Price's problems this season have anything to do with the defense that's in front of him?
Price's problems are a combination of things, and some of these are fair, some of these aren't. His first problem is that he's a very young goaltender, and I don't honestly have his bio up in front of me, but last year was his rookie.
He's 21.
He's 21, which in terms of hockey goaltending is a babe. I mean, he's an infant. And yeah. I think that last year's experience in the playoffs, I think he got overworked last year. He got into a huge pressure environment in the playoffs, and I think he folded a little bit. And I think that Carboneau went to the whip to try and motivate him, try and call him out, as is, you know, it's a perfectly acceptable coaching tactic. It works with some players. And it, for whatever reason, it didn't work with Carey Price. And I think that then to pile on, and this is the part that he maybe isn't, you know, that maybe isn't fair to Carey Price, but he is renowned for having a very relaxed, very, you know, kind of laid back demeanor. And mm-hmm. he's playing the most intense position in one of the most intense markets in all of the NHL. And so I think that one of the biggest problems with him is he doesn't look like he cares. And that's opened him up for even more criticism, both from his coaches who have criticized, and from his city and from his teammates. I mean, people have piled onto the kid because he just carries himself like, you know, no big deal. And so I think that it's just kind of built and turned into this situation where it's a goaltender that really probably needs more time to grow into his job, getting hammered from every single side about not being good enough. And, you know, that's going to get to a guy.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens over the course of the next couple of weeks to see if Gainey decides to pick up somebody else or if he stays in charge himself, and see whether or not they can hang on to that playoff spot that they've got right now.
I think this team has a ton of free agents. Gainey sticks on for the rest of the season to see sees who he wants to re-sign.
Yeah, fair enough.
I can't believe Matthew Schneider is still playing hockey.
He's terrible.
I've been thinking about that. I just can't believe it.
He has not been terrible since he's been in Montreal. In fact, he's been pretty damn good since he's been in Montreal. He was terrible with the Thrashers, but that is not his fault because the Thrashers are a soul-crushing organization. We've talked about
Kovalchuk.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Kovalchuk succeeds in a vacuum, you know?
Yeah.
And his soul might be crushed. He might be doing better elsewhere.
That's true.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm quite sure that
his soul is so strong that it just overcomes a lot of the power.
He has a Russian soul. It's tempered in Siberian winters.
That's right. So it shrinks, but it doesn't die.
That's right. He's got soul shrinkage.
That's right.
Soul shrinkage. Well, the last thing that I wanted to chat about just very briefly is Martin Brodeur. Obviously, has just recently come back from injury. In his first couple of games back, he had first three games back, two shutouts, gave up three goals total or two goals total. He's really been nothing short of phenomenal recently. Right now, as we speak, the Devils are up 5-1 on the Coyotes. So after this game, I think that Brodeur will be one win away from Patrick Waugh's record for the most wins by a goaltender in the NHL. And I'm just curious to know what y'all's perspectives are on whether or not Martin Brodeur might be the greatest NHL goaltender of all time.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about it, well, the whole time you guys were talking about that, and Patrick Waugh is the only person that I think you could even, I mean, put up there with him. And I don't even know his stats well enough to know whether or not he's really, really great or just had a lot of hype during his career.
He was really great. I think that Brodeur is the greatest goaltender of all time. I think that he is unfortunately going to play out his final years in a shootout league, and I think that he's going to piss off purists because he's going to add, you know, 5 to 10 wins a season that his team is picking up in the shootout, and the huffy, you know, hockey traditionalists are going to poo-poo those. But I just think that he is a special talent. I think that he is a better player than Patrick Waugh. I think that he's a better goaltender, and I don't think that he had as much help on his New Jersey championship teams as Patrick Waugh had on any of the teams he won with in Colorado. And I think that you really have to admire a guy who won a Stanley Cup playoff game after receiving a call from, I believe it was his brother-in-law, or it was his – I'm trying to remember the story for life. He received a call from, like, his brother-in-law saying he was having sex with his wife, or
yes.
He received a call from his brother saying that he was having sex with his wife, or some ridiculous circumstance, and then Berdour goes out and wins a playoff game.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about mental stamina and moxie. I mean, it's hard to fault Berdour on any of that stuff. He certainly has always been exceptionally well prepared. He's always a rock in goal. I guess my question is, I think that Wall retired just a little bit earlier, but I don't know. Wall always seemed to me to be more intimidating in goal. Berdour is one of those guys who has always just struck me as, I mean, not that he's not intimidating, he is just because of his skill, but he doesn't seem to have the same presence on the ice.
I agree with you. He doesn't have, Wall had the crazy eyes.
Yes, exactly.
I feel the exact opposite, actually.
Really?
I mean, I'm sorry to cut in. I grew up a Stars fan, and, you know, we definitely, The Stars were definitely always concerned about Waugh, and I always, as a fan, was extremely nervous when they were playing Waugh because he was incredible. But he didn't have the same mystique to me that Martin Brodeur had. Brodeur is the guy to me that if my team is lining up against a guy in a must win situation, I am most terrified that goaltender is going to be Martin Brodeur.
I think that that's fair because I think what Andrew's saying, what I'm saying is that his sort of physical presence isn't the same sort of intimidating as a human, like just the look of him, just sort of the feel of him. To me, Brodeur's sort of, he's icy cool. Like the reason he's intimidating or he's, you don't want to play him or he's scary is because you know he's not going to screw up, but he doesn't look scary. He's not insane, sort of like Wall.
I see that. I definitely see what you're saying.
Yeah, that's to me. That's kind of the, you know, I think of just him in those Avalanche games and his eyes, and it's just like he's like to me. He makes me think of like Dave. He's like he's just, you know, for Ken will get the reference.
our listener.
That's shout out to our listener.
So anyway, no, yeah, there's no point in explaining that reference. But I think that he's crazy. He looked crazy, and Brodeur looked just like you're not going to get past him, but not like because he's going to pull out some. Also, he's not going to screw up. Everything's solid. Where Waugh is kind of like all over the place, yet he gets the job done in the end.
Yeah, I believed at any given time that Patrick Waugh could do something utterly spectacular that would just make you shit your pants with excitement because it was so completely unexpected. Whereas
but with Brodeur, I think that's a double-edged sword with Waugh, though. I mean, one of my endearing Patrick Waugh memories is from Yzerman's last cup with Detroit, where Waugh goes to make the Statue of Liberty save. He's standing there with his glove over his head. Steve Yzerman skates up behind him and pokes the puck into the empty net. I think that more often than not, Waugh had that mystique to him, but especially later in his career, I think that Brodeur is to me more intimidating and scarier because of how robotic he is. I can't, even when he has bad games, I forget about those bad games. He gave up 6 the other night, but it doesn't shock me to hear that he's winning 5-1 this night. Whereas with Patrick Waugh, like, you knew that more often than not, his craziness was going to be good, but he did have meltdowns.
I agree with you, and the course of this conversation has made me decide that Brodeur is the superior goalie. Because of exactly, I was picturing in my mind that same Steve Yzerman situation, that Brodeur's better because at the end of the day, the goalie's not supposed to make you stand there and say, shit, that was awesome. The goalie is not there for that. The goalie is there to never make that sort of thing. That shouldn't happen because the goalie should be positioned better so that nothing exciting ever has to happen.
I want my goaltender to be just like I want my team's leading goal scorer, and that's just ruthless. It's kind of the, you know, I want my team's leading goal scorer to get a chance, take the chance, and bury the puck. And every now and then he's going to do something phenomenal, and it's going to impress me. But more often than not, he's making the right play and just burying the puck. And I feel the same way on the goalie. You know, every now and then I want him to make a spectacular save, but more often than not, I want him to slide out, clear it, and be done.
Absolutely. One of my favorite stories about Martin Brodeur, and I do agree with what you guys are saying, and I think that – not that Martin Brodeur doesn't make spectacular saves on a regular basis, because obviously he does, but I guess I just I always expect it out of him because he always has been so consistent. But my favorite story about Martin Brodeur, this would have been back in the early 2000s probably, when Stéphane Richer was on the Devils. They're in practice one day, and people are taking slap shots against Brodeur. And Richer, who, mind you, was clocked one time at having a 112-mile-an-hour slap shot, takes one that hits Brodeur square in the cup. And he has to skate off the ice, and it turns out the cup cracked in half. And so he's in the bathroom vomiting up blood because he's just taken 112-mile-an-hour huge-ass piece of rubber right to the gonads. But he goes back out on the ice and he finishes practice. And then a little while later, the Hockey Hall of Fame calls him up and asks for the cup. So now I believe you can go to Kingston, Ontario and see the cup that was cracked in half by the Stéphane Richer slap shot. The fact – that's incredible to me. The fact that not only that he was able to deal with that, but that he was able to go back out and practice after something like that, that says it all about Martin Brodeur.
He should – Allen Iverson could have taken a lesson from that.
not even a game. We talking about practice.
Exactly. We talking about
speaking of which, changing subjects, because we're almost done, 6 minutes left. This next Tuesday, I'm going to the Bulls Celtics game, and Stefan Marbury is now a Celtic.
Nice. You got to get a pair of $20 Starberries.
You can't anymore because the store that sells them went under.
Yep. So, more Starberries. They're cheap.
But Starberry himself is going to be at the United Center, and I'm going to get to watch him. It's going to be great.
I'm very thrilled. Arbery all night.
And then the Formula One starts in like 15 days. And
yes.
And just the other day, Ross Brown, who used to run, like to manage the Ferrari, just bought Honda's Formula One program. And they put out their car for the first tests and the only test that they're going to be allowed to do this week. And it's been the fastest car every session. And testing ended today, and they're not allowed to do any more until the first race. So we might have this ex-Honda team, because no one knows how good any of the cars are, because like nobody's had time to do any testing. And so this is going to be like a shit show. The first race, and it could end up that this Ross Brown, it's Brown F1 is the name, but it's spelled Braun, but it's pronounced Brown, I guess. So it's Brown F1 might be the fastest car on the grid.
That's pretty fantastic. I'm not going to lie. I had heard some Brazilian investors had dumped some money into the former Honda team, but nice to hear that somebody actually took them up, and that they're doing so well. I mean, I know that McLaren has had some difficulties, especially with Hamilton getting adjusted to the car. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in that first race for sure.
Yeah, part of me thinks that maybe they're just that Ross is just trying. He's just pushing the drivers to get some good lap times in, so they can go tell some potential sponsors that they have a really fast car this year, and they might be able to win some races. But I don't know. Yeah, it'll be interesting. We have no idea what's going to happen.
Well, it'll be an exciting subject for a future podcast.
That's exactly
right. I'm excited right now.
I know you are, Wes. I can feel your excitement. Yeah. Or something. Anyways.
I can feel it.
All right. Well, I think we're about out of time for this evening, but lovely chatting with you gents as always. And to all of our many listener out there, we will be back next week, I think, ideally, with another exciting episode of Speaking English. Good evening, y'all.
Good night.
Good night, guys. I got to go eat some.